welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, August 11th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble contributor Doreen Nichol sits down with David Fancy, a disability advocate and a co-founder of the Well Earth Collaborative. David Fancy is a professor in the Department of Dramatic Arts at Brock University, is the co-founder of Well Earth Collaborative, and is finishing training as a registered psychotherapist. Doreen Nichol is a freelance writer and frequent contributor to Rabble.ca. Here are Doreen Nichol and David Fancy in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, David, and welcome to Rabble Radio.
Hi, Doreen. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really thrilled to be able to speak to you today about your disability advocacy work. You're a professor at the Department of Dramatic Arts at Brock University. In the process of finishing your qualifications to become a registered psychotherapist and a disability advocate. So your advocacy really grew out of your own healing journey, and that began after you had mercury dental fillings removed. Could you tell Rabble listeners how your health and life were impacted by that?
Yeah, of course. It's an interesting story that involves, you know, coming up against some real challenges from having mercury amalgam fillings removed, and that then precipitating a series of autoimmune illnesses that led to what's described as significant electrical hypersensitivity. And I didn't really know what was happening. I had had my fillings out in my late 20s, and then about a year later, and it was done improperly. I realized later I was essentially poisoned with these metals. And about a year after that, I started to get sore hands around a computer, whistling in my ears on a phone. And then before long, within a year or two after that, I went into full-blown electrical hypersensitivity, which meant that it was difficult to be around a light bulb, let alone be indoors in a wireless environment. So that led to a whole series of transformations in how I needed to live my life. I, first of all, sought out a diagnosis and got that at Women's College Hospital, the environmental health clinic there, headed up by Dr. Rena Bray. And she explained that I had electrical hypersensitivity, which I sort of knew at that point because I'd done the research, I'd figured it out. But to get that legitimation through the diagnosis was key. But I had to live outdoors for a couple of years, Doreen. I suddenly was unhoused. I couldn't be indoors. I lived in a tent through three Canadian winters. Then as I gradually figured out that the metal was in part the problem, in addition to the ambient high levels of electromagnetic pollution that we're all exposed to, I gradually got rid of some of the mercury and over time could move back indoors. But it led to all kinds of need for accommodation in wireless free zones where I teach. I didn't miss a day of work because I really couldn't afford to, but then did that work. And what was key through that whole journey, Doreen, was recognizing that many other people were facing similar challenges. They perhaps, for whatever reason, did not have access to physicians, did not have access to resources to live in their car or in a tent for a couple of years, were spending all of their money trying to get by, lost their jobs, so on and so forth. So there's a whole cadre of individuals in Ontario and beyond living with these complex chronic conditions that are environmentally linked that sometimes express as these environmental sensitivities like electrical hypersensitivity or multiple chemical sensitivity. Now, fortunately, these were recognized in around 2007 by various publications from the Canadian Human Rights Commission as actually being disabilities. And so that gave me some leverage to collaborate with others to look for work accommodations, to try to find resources, to make spaces, work, and otherwise accessible. Because I'll be honest, a lot of this came up for me was, you know, certain people, certain physicians go, yeah, we don't believe you, or where's your tinfoil hat, or you're crazy, and maybe the aliens abducted you, and that's your problem. you know, and I might be a lot of things, but I'm very rational. I proceed via evidence. I'm an empiricist, and I was clocking when I was exposed to a cell phone or a cell phone tower. These days of inflammation and pain and brain fog would ensue. So it was really important to get that recognition in place. And then it's just been a whole long-term process of continuing the work of disability advocacy, of supporting the many others in this situation in Ontario and beyond as best as possible, through starting up an organization with Rose Smith and Martin Weatherall in 2006 called WEEP, the Working to Eliminate Electromagnetic Pollution. And that did a lot of advocacy work. Collaborating with other groups like Canadians or Citizens for Safe Technology, working to do public education campaigns with Women College Hospital, and so on and so forth. Just in closing, to refer to the issue of becoming a psychotherapist, it was clear that people living with these realities were under such significant psychosocial pressures that profound depression, anxiety, and other mental health realities could express themselves simply through the social isolation, the long-term pain, the all the ways in which disabled persons are minoritized when there is no accommodation for their disability, and frequently misunderstandings of that disability in the medical, HR, and other communities. So a variety of physician friends encouraged me to get a psychotherapy degree so that I could continue the advocacy work, but with an increased capacity to be of assistance in a frontline fashion to the many people who are experiencing these challenges. So that's why I've been doing a lot of disability life coach counseling and moving towards this final qualification of, you know, who needs one job when you can have two? I'm a registered psychotherapist to help deal with the psychosocial realities that come up when people are under these tremendous pressures.
It's really clear that you're very dedicated to this. In fact, you helped start Well Earth Collective, or WEC, we'll call it WEC for short, in 2018. So why did you and Dr. Rena Bray feel that this nonprofit was really needed?
So the Well Earth Collaborative came out of an idea that Rena had for the need for community engaged and charitable support to help connect, on one level, physicians, naturopaths, dentists, work as psychotherapists, spiritual advisors working together to support this really significant population in Ontario. She's been the medical director of the environmental health clinic at Women's College Hospital for a couple of decades and wanted to intensify the access to the hundreds and hundreds of people seeking care in that facility through an integrated form of outreach networked care, along with public education, networking between physicians and other practitioners, allied health practitioners. The work has been to see what the needs are of this disabled population, how to prevent people from falling into profound despair and all kinds of difficult things that come from that, networking patients and people living in this community together so that there's all kinds of abilities for mutual support, and fundraising with an affiliate charity that we have registered with the Canada Revenue Agency called Friends of the Healing Forest that looks to supply educational materials, but also support for housing for people who are unhoused or have become unhoused because of these challenges. So it's been a really important sort of coming together of a whole range of persons to look at supporting this population, but also to think more broadly, Doreen, about the idea of reciprocal healing between human health and environmental health, planetary healing, ecological wellness, human wellness. Because in many cases, such as in my own case, it was poisoning from environmental toxicants that triggered this extreme environmental illness. And we're really seeing across the board, and this has always been the lived experience of Indigenous persons, racialized and minoritized persons in this country and others, that exposure to effluent and off-gassing and radiation from the byproducts of manufacturing or the consumer economy really affect people and affect the most vulnerable people more. So there's a real health equity issue that needs to be addressed by this not-for-profit, by the related charity, and how this can contribute to how humans live along with other than human and the more than human world in a way that's not based on supremacy, exploitation between humans or between humans and the environment. So we're really trying to ask, create a forum to ask ourselves these broader questions of what does equity seeking living look like in a way that allows healing for these really radically marginalized and unwell patients and population in an environmental setting that is vectoring towards flourishing as opposed to exploitation, pollution, and ecological degradation.
These are often called hidden conditions that WEC members and others experience. They include multiple sensitivities, electromagnetic emission sensitivities, Lyme's disease, and fibromyalgia. Why are these really disability issues, and how do they lead to people becoming unhoused?
Well, imagine a circumstance where someone has, you know, in another condition recognized, and here is CFS or chronic fatigue, ME. Imagine that you have a form of fatigue which is ontological, existential in its nature, and you can only have a shower if you're lucky every couple of days and barely feed yourself. And there's perhaps some environmental linking in there that has contributed to that. It's not as if you need an assist, a sort of a mobility device, and some people do, but it's invisible because it does not present itself to a viewer who's seeing you in public or seeing you in some other form as disabled. We have the cliche of disability being the person who has a significant mobility challenge or perhaps has a differential corporeal engagement. They might be not have a limb, or they might be unsighted, or they don't have hearing capacity. The invisibility of the disability renders it harder to get care for. This has just been borne out by the literature, and it's borne out by people's experience. If a person has multiple chemical sensitivity, for example, and we see this often, Doreen, it's a really difficult and frankly tragic part of this entire conversation. A person with multiple chemical sensitivity is living on ODSP, so $1,200 bucks a month. We know how much it costs to rent anywhere in this province, even in a small town. $1,200 might get you a room. The thing about renting a room in someone else's house is that then you are exposed to the odors and scents, food, chemicals, and otherwise, that might trigger, in many cases, trigger people with multiple chemical sensitivity into a system-wide, an organ system-wide response involving autoimmunity, inflammation, so on and so forth, that can be life-threatening. This is not a question of a person being a little precocious about they don't like the smell of someone's perfume. This is about people for whom a couple of molecules of a chemical sets off a chain reaction within their bodies that leads to, in some cases, life-threatening conditions, particularly if it's regularized. Right, if it happens all the time. Electrical sensitivity, similar. How are you going to find a place that doesn't have someone else's wireless, a nearby cell phone tower? Same kinds of reactions can occur. So frequently people end up being unhoused without the resources to find housing. Their level of suffering becomes very significant. And people frequently take their own lives. Or recently, because of the state's evolution in the medical assistance and dying legislation and how it's been operationalized here in Ontario and across all provinces, will have the state take their life for them. So you have this really unfortunate mission creep, if you will, where a person has a medical condition that is also simultaneously a disability. It's important to recognize these are both occurring at the same time. The individual then suffers extensively, but would suffer much less if there were an accessible location for them to live, to work, to love, to play, to flourish. Not having that because it's not recognized, even though the AODA, the Accessibility for Interns with Disability Act, should protect people with these conditions. accessibility and accommodation is very frequently an issue. So abject levels of suffering, mental, physical, and emotional, begin occurring because of minoritization, continuous pain, the threat of, you know, these exposures leading to extreme physiological reactions on a regular basis. It puts people not only into unhoused positions, but frequently much more deeply existentially precarious conditions where they think, well, why should I be living? The level of suffering is so high.
What has held several campaigns to raise funds to buy apartments or houses so individuals don't turn to MAID? But in June, WEC launched a new one-year-long fundraising event. WEC is raising money to build tiny homes in the country away from electromagnetic pollution and close to a yet-to-be-built medical treatment center. This would give individuals with environmental sensitivities a much-needed respite and an opportunity to heal. David, can you tell Rabble listeners why this is such an important project?
Certainly. You know, what's really interesting about this project, Doreen, is that this in many ways enacts the spirit of an important report that was presented, generated by the government. It was an environment, a task force in environmental health. It resulted in the Care Now report in 2018, and it was taken up by the Ministry of Health and the provincial government. And it essentially made clear statistically that there are 740,000 patients in Ontario where these forms of disabilities are really ubiquitous in the population. And that report suggested any number of things, including the need for proper care, accommodation, medical centers of excellence to service those needs. Very little, if none of the recommendations out of that report have been carried forward. Thus, the urgency felt by Rena Bray, her colleagues, those of us at the Well Earth Collaborative, many others across the province, to provide accessible living circumstances for people who respond to chemical and electromagnetic emissions in a way that risks their life and limb. And so it's been a part of our work over the last couple of years to do emergency help for people who are on medical assistance and dying lists, with whom we've collaborated or certainly advised on how to do fundraising to support themselves. In some instances, this has helped people make the decision to remove themselves from the medical assistance and dying list. In other cases, from a trauma-informed perspective, people are so deeply troubled by years of insecurity that it's difficult, even with the prospect of housing, to kind of think, is my life still safe and worth living? So thus the need for any number of community supports and interventions. So the idea of a collective housing circumstance, one of eventually many, on a property somewhere that is not heavily inflected with electromagnetic emissions or downwind from a chemical kind of plant or something that would provide, you know, people with the opportunity for some breathing space, literally and figuratively. We're looking at creating this kind of space so that there can be short and long-term living circumstances for the many people we engage with at the moment who are unhoused because of these realities. And so the need to have that housing in tiny homes built to code with no toxic materials, no off-gassing, no formaldehyde, no VOCs, certain forms of electromagnetic protections in the wiring and in the grounding so that there's the most limited form of exposure possible. This will need to be complemented by a medical center, which is also part of what the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care argued for in the Care Now report, is centers of excellence that can continue to provide specialized care. There is wonderful work that happens downtown Toronto at Women's College Hospital, the environmental health clinic. I know for a fact that many people with electromagnetic and multiple chemical sensitivities find it near impossible to travel into the city. So that the care needs to go to where the individuals are, the treatment, the diagnosis, the care management, the collaboration with allied healthcare professionals has to occur in the zones and locations where people are having these challenges.
At the moment, do you have any land in mind?
We're in conversation with a variety of different people who have 100 acres here or 200 acres there, an organic farm or a collaborative sort of. There's a lot of beautiful people in the world, and we're in conversations with lots of them. It's a multi-pronged process. So you've got 100 acres of land. You're comfortable giving us a 99-year lease for the back 15 acres. We can have a variety of, you know, tiny homes there. But then what we'd have to do is make sure that we worked with Industry Canada to see where all the local cell phone towers were, started an advocacy campaign to make sure that no cell phone or other telecommunications installations would go up in the environs. And, you know, Health Canada and the so-called Safety Code 6 that regulates electromagnetic emissions, for example, is based on a thermal model of health protection based from science in the 1930s and for all kinds of complicated reasons refused to update, even though the World Health Organization has recognized radio frequency as a potential carcinogen in 2014. And with the literature that's out there now, I wouldn't be surprised eventually they have to concede that it is carcinogenic, not just potentially. At any rate, there's so much work that needs to be done on a variety of fronts, but we're getting there. And part of the conversation is to then find donors who are interested in purchasing tiny homes for people to live in or contributing, if it's their interest, to an educational campaign or something related. So it's a multi-pronged process, and we're just, you know, clumsily but beautifully and anarchistically kind of moving through it as best as possible.
Other than 99-year leases with, say, a farmer, which is a great idea, what about Crown land or other prospects?
We've had informational conversations with Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation about if we were to get land that was Crown or, you know, either provincial or federal, what kind of access road would we need? What kind of would we need to make sure that mineral and logging rights weren't engaged in? What conversations would we need to have with Indigenous collaborators to ensure that it wasn't the reinscription of yet another kind of colonial dynamic on land use that has traditional and historical uses that we wouldn't want to be impacting upon? I mean, this whole, we have a variety of different Indigenous colleagues as part of the overall network of people working on policy and medical and other interventions. And that's got to be an important kind of way forward. So Crown land leasing, the challenge with farming is that, you know, with farming, there's usually an use of chemicals, or there's a diesel fired tractor that's going to run by a couple times a week in the summer. And again, with individuals with extreme multiple chemical sensitivity, all it takes is a couple of molecules to send people off into their central sensitization syndrome is triggered, and there's full body effects. So you can see there's a lot of variables. What's arguably beautiful and educational about this for everybody, Doreen, is that we all need to learn to live without toxic crap, without relations of extraction and exploitation between ourselves and also in relationship with the more than human world, that this presents a beautiful spiritual, almost leadership opportunity for a group of people who are suffering and for those who are collaborating with them. I don't say helping, I say collaborating with, because that power sharing is an important part of this emergence of a new way of thinking. That's going to be absolutely an important mode of leadership of how we can all collectively reduce the toxic exposures resulting from consumer capitalism, industrial and techno-capitalism, to sort of provide ourselves with a mode of healing that's much more in tune with the natural environment's capacities for resilience and coming to flourishing.
David, this has been so enlightening and educating. I'm just so thrilled we were able to talk today, and I'm sure we're going to talk again. Thank you so much.
My great pleasure, and always such a treat to read your writing, Doreen, and so good to have had the chance to do this work together. Thank you so much for your time.
That was Rabble contributor Doreen Nickel and David Fancy, co-founder of the Well Earth Collaborative, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Doreen and David. Switching gears now, I'd like to catch you up on the top news stories of the week on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Let's dive in. This week in Canadian politics, columnist Kathy Crowe pens a letter on Rabble.ca to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In the piece, Crowe condemns Trudeau over a comment he made at a recent appearance at an affordable housing announcement in Hamilton, Ontario, in which he pronounced housing is not a primary federal responsibility and not something he has direct carriage of. Crowe argues that this is exactly the sort of thing he is responsible for. She writes, quote, "Housing is the most fundamental building block of health, of a successful future for a household, the community, and the nation. You could never get away with saying that Medicare or pensions or unemployment insurance are not your responsibility." End quote. In labor news, Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga outlines the subtler ways climate change is affecting Canadians' lives and how we must reorganize labor for climate preparedness. In the piece, Kaluge-Kasuga speaks to Angela McEwen, a senior economist at the Canadian Union of Public Employees, or CUPE. McEwen considers, quote, "Would we work later in the day when it's not as hot? Would it be okay to not do work on days when it is unsafe? Would the employer be okay not doing things on certain days and doing it on a different day? Can this happen without penalty for the workers? We need to take those types of things more seriously. What are the impacts and the stresses on people?" End quote. Finally, a word from a rabble-rouser to watch, Anjali Apadurai.
Hi, I'm Anjali Apadurai with the Climate Emergency Unit and the Padma Center for Climate Justice. At the Climate Emergency Unit, we bring together institutions and networks and organizations around big, audacious, emergency-level climate policy ideas like a Youth Climate Corps and a Just Transition Transfer. And at the Padma Center for Climate Justice, we build capacity and leadership within diasporic communities towards climate justice. I'm so honored to be named a Rabble Rouser to Watch in 2023 by Rabble Readership. So thrilled and deeply grateful for this, and I'm grateful to be in our common struggle together. And if you want to learn more, you can read my interview at rabble.ca.
Thanks, Anjali. For this and all the stories mentioned today, you can find the full version on rabble.ca.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe news for the rest of us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help Rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nierenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.